A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about bonded warehouses, this strange category of building where goods are physically inside a country but legally haven't arrived yet, a customs limbo. And his question is really about physical form. Does bonded warehouse always mean a giant facility near a port, or can it mean something much smaller, a room, a cage, a locker at an airport?
Over 2,900 of these facilities are authorized by U Customs and Border Protection right now. And most people picture one thing, a 100,000-square-foot warehouse stacked with shipping containers near a port. That's the classic image. You see it in movies, you drive past them on the highway approaching any major city. But here's what's actually happening. E-commerce is driving demand for bonded spaces that are maybe 200 square feet. A cage at an airport cargo terminal. The physical footprint is shrinking, and the classic image is increasingly wrong.
The tension here is between what we picture and what's actually being built. A bonded warehouse sounds like a building, but it's really a legal status that can attach to almost any secure space. And that gap between the name and the reality is where the interesting stuff lives. It's like calling a food truck a restaurant. Technically true in a regulatory sense, but the word restaurant conjures a specific image that the food truck deliberately violates.
That's exactly the right analogy, and it matters because the supply chain decisions that flow from understanding that gap are worth real money. Duty deferral, cash flow, transshipment routing, all of it turns on knowing that bonded is a customs designation, not a floor plan. If you're a logistics manager making decisions based on the mental image of a giant portside warehouse, you're leaving options on the table.
Where do we even start with this? What actually makes a warehouse bonded?
At its core, a bonded warehouse is a secure facility where customs says, "We'll trust you to hold these goods without collecting duties yet," but you're putting up a financial guarantee. That guarantee is the customs bond itself. It's typically a surety bond from an insurance company or a specialized broker, and it covers the potential duties if goods vanish or get diverted into the domestic market illegally.
The bond is the legal engine. Without it, the whole arrangement collapses. But I want to pause on that word, surety, because it's one of those terms that sounds like legal jargon, but actually describes something quite specific. A surety bond is an insurance in the conventional sense. It's a three-party agreement. The warehouse operator is the principal, customs is the obligee, and the surety company is the guarantor. If the operator violates the terms, customs makes a claim against the bond, the surety pays out, and then the surety turns around and collects from the operator. So the operator is ultimately on the hook. The surety is just vouching for them.
And that creates a powerful incentive structure. The surety company does its own due diligence before issuing the bond. They're not going to back a warehouse operator who looks likely to lose a shipment of electronics. So the bond functions as a market-based screening mechanism. Customs doesn't have to investigate every warehouse operator's financials in depth. They let the surety market do that work.
Which is a neat piece of institutional design. The government offloads the vetting to private actors who have a financial stake in getting it right.
That bond creates this strange legal fiction that I find genuinely elegant. The goods are physically sitting on U soil. You could walk up and touch them, but legally they're outside the customs territory. They haven't been imported yet. That's why if you re-export them directly from bonded storage, you pay zero duties. They never formally entered the country.
Which is a phrase that would sound absurd in any other context. The crate is right there. But legally, it's a ghost. I'm imagining explaining this to someone from 200 years ago. Yes, the barrels of rum are sitting in that building in Boston, but as far as the law is concerned, they're still in the Caribbean.
CBP takes this seriously enough to have built an entire classification system around it. 12 classes of bonded warehouse, from Class 0 through Class 12. The two that matter for most general merchandise are Class 11, that's public, Anyone can store goods there, and Class 12, which is private, meaning only the operators own goods.
When Daniel asks whether bonded always means a giant facility, the classification system already hints at the answer. Class 11 is a public utility, essentially. Class 12 is a company's private inventory tool. Same legal status, completely different operational logic. One is a storage service you buy from someone else. The other is an extension of your own supply chain.
The classes go well beyond those two. There are specific designations for grain, for smelting and refining metals, for cigar manufacturing. CBP has thought through the edge cases. But the organizing principle across all 12 is the same. The bond is what makes the limbo real, and the physical space just has to be secure enough for customs to sign off.
I want to dig into the cigar one for a second, because it's such a specific carve-out. Why does cigar manufacturing get its own bonded warehouse class?
It's a legacy of the tariff code, basically. Cigars have historically carried extremely high duties, and the manufacturing process involves importing raw tobacco, aging it, rolling it, and then often exporting the finished product. If you had to pay duties on the raw tobacco at the moment of import, you'd be tying up enormous amounts of capital during the aging process, which can take years. So the Class 6 bonded warehouse lets cigar manufacturers bring in tobacco, store it, process it, and only pay duties if and when the finished cigars enter the U. If they export to Europe, duties were never owed.
It's the same cash flow logic as the electronics or the spirits, but with a production step in the middle. The government is effectively saying, we want the manufacturing jobs here even if the raw materials and finished goods are both foreign.
And that's a pattern you see across the bonded warehouse classes. They're not just about storage, they're about enabling specific economic activities that would be unworkable under immediate duty payment.
The legal fiction is the product. The warehouse is just the packaging.
Let's talk about the physical spectrum, because this is where the mental model most people carry around breaks. The classic bonded warehouse is exactly what you'd picture, 100,000 square feet or more, sitting near a major port or land border, Long Beach, Newark, Houston. Rows of shipping containers holding raw materials, electronics, pallets of alcohol waiting for someone to pay the duties and release them.
Most of those 2,900 plus CBP authorized facilities are that type. Big, slow, port side. But I want to put a finer point on the scale here. 100,000 square feet. That's roughly two football fields under one roof. You could lose a small airplane in that space. And these facilities often operate 24 hours a day with their own loading docks, customs inspection bays, and inventory management systems that have to track every item down to the SKU level, because CBP can audit at any time.
But here's the thing. Bonded status cares about security, not square footage. CBP wants locks, alarms, inventory tracking, access logs, and regular audits. If you can meet those requirements in a 200 square foot cage at JFK's cargo terminal, that cage is a bonded warehouse. Same legal designation as the 100,000 square foot facility in Long Beach.
The smallest possible bonded warehouse is whatever size room you can convince a customs officer to certify. And I'm curious about that process. What does it actually take to get a space designated as bonded?
You file an application with CBP. You submit a blueprint of the space showing the security features, locks, cameras, access controls, and you post the bond. A CBP officer does a physical inspection. They're looking for things like, can this space be secured against unauthorized entry? Is there a clear boundary between the bonded area and the rest of the facility? Can inventory be tracked accurately? If you're talking about a cage at an airport, the cage itself becomes the customs boundary. The lock on that cage door is functionally a border checkpoint.
The customs officer is essentially verifying that this cage, this room, this closet can function as a miniature border. The lock is the port of entry.
Airports have been the big driver of that shrinkage. At major cargo hubs, JFK, LAX, Frankfurt, freight forwarders operate these small bonded cages, sometimes literally just 200 square feet, for high-value time-sensitive goods. Pharmaceuticals that need to clear within hours. Electronic shipments where every day of delay costs real money. The goods land, sit in the cage, clear customs, and move on.
200 square feet. That's a generous walk-in closet. I'm picturing something the size of a New York City studio apartment, but filled with pallets of iPhones instead of a futon and a hot plate.
There's an even more extreme version, the in-transit variant. Goods arrive at an airport and depart on the same aircraft or within 24 hours. They never need formal warehousing at all, just a secure holding area that's bonded. This is what makes transshipment hubs work. Singapore, Dubai, Leipzig. The bonded space is essentially a temporary cage where cargo changes planes without ever legally entering the country.
You've got the full warehouse, the airport cage, and then this in-transit holding area which barely qualifies as storage. All the same legal status. The in-transit version is almost philosophical. The goods are in the country, but the country is just a hallway they're walking through.
DHL runs exactly this model at their Leipzig-Halle airport hub. Small high-throughput bonded cages, class 11 public spaces, but operating at parcel scale. Individual packages held for customs clearance before final delivery. It's a bonded warehouse in every legal sense, and it looks nothing like the Long Beach facility. You'd walk past it and think it was just a sorting area with some extra fencing.
The wine example sticks with me. You mentioned it earlier. I want to really sit with that because it illustrates the economics so cleanly.
London Heathrow's cargo terminal has temperature-controlled bonded lockers for individual pallets of vintage wine. You're storing something where a single pallet might be worth more than the building it sits in. And the duty deferral economics are wild. In the U, alcohol duties hit $13.50 per proof gallon for distilled spirits. If you're holding thousands of gallons, the cash flow savings from deferring that payment are enormous. You'd store it in a locker if that's what customs required.
Let's do the math on that wine pallet. A standard pallet can hold roughly 60 cases of wine. At 12 bottles per case, that's 720 bottles. If each bottle is a $100 Bordeaux, you're looking at $72,000 in wine on a single pallet. The duty on still wine entering the U is around 5 to 15 cents per bottle, depending on alcohol content and type, so the per bottle duty is modest. But if you're a wine distributor holding dozens of pallets, the aggregate deferral is significant. And more importantly, you're not paying duties on wine that might ultimately ship to a restaurant in Toronto or a collector in Tokyo.
The temperature control adds another layer. Wine needs stable conditions. You can't just leave it in a standard cargo cage. So these bonded lockers at Heathrow are climate controlled to within a degree or two, humidity monitored, with backup power systems. They're more like wine cellars than warehouses. But the customs designation is identical to the facility in Long Beach.
Which gets at something Daniel's question implies. The name bonded warehouse creates a picture of scale that's increasingly misleading. It's not a building type. It's a customs agreement with a lock on it. The word warehouse is doing a lot of misleading work here. It suggests bulk, pallets, forklifts, but the legal reality doesn't care about any of that.
If bonded is a customs agreement with a lock on it, the strategic question flips. It's not, do I need a warehouse? It's where in my supply chain does deferring duties create the most value?
That's where e-commerce has scrambled the old logic. The classic model assumed goods would sit in bonded storage for weeks or months, but Amazon doesn't think in months. They want inventory parked as close to customers as possible, and they want duties paid only at the last possible moment. The old model was a reservoir. The new model is a canal with locks, goods flow through, and duties are the toll that gets paid at the final gate.
Amazon's bonded facilities at regional airports are exactly this play. Goods arrive from overseas, sit in bonded storage near the final delivery zone, sometimes just miles from the customer, and duties get paid only when the item actually ships. It shrinks the physical footprint from a portside warehouse to what's essentially a bonded last-mile node. The space is smaller, the turnover is faster, and the cash flow advantage is the same legal mechanism.
What does that actually look like on the ground? If I'm Amazon, and I'm setting up one of these bonded last-mile nodes, am I building something new or repurposing existing space?
They'll take an existing facility near a regional airport, maybe a former distribution center or even a large commercial space, and designate a portion of it as bonded. They'll install the required security, separate access, cameras, inventory tracking that integrates with CBP's systems. The rest of the building operates as a standard fulfillment center. But that one section, maybe a few thousand square feet, is legally outside the United States.
You could literally have a painted line on the floor, and on one side of the line, goods are in America, and on the other side, they're in customs limbo. The line is a border.
That's exactly what it is. And employees working in the bonded zone typically need additional clearance or at least additional training. They're handling goods that haven't been legally imported. If they accidentally move a pallet across that line without proper documentation, they've just committed an illegal import.
Which is a fascinating workplace safety briefing. Watch out for forklifts, and also don't accidentally smuggle.
The calculus for a supply chain manager becomes a real trade-off. Portside bonded warehouse, lower cost per square foot, longer storage windows, typically class 11, so you're sharing the space. Airport bonded cage, higher cost, faster clearance, proximity to air freight. You're trading storage economics for velocity.
The deciding variable is usually inventory carrying cost versus duty deferral value. Let me put numbers on this because it's where the abstraction becomes a spreadsheet. You import $1 million of electronics. Duty rate is 5%. If you clear customs immediately, you write a check for $50,000 the moment those goods enter the country. If you put them in bonded storage, that $50,000 stays in your account for the duration. It's an interest-free loan from customs.
If you're turning inventory quickly, maybe that doesn't matter much. But if you're holding goods for 90 days, or if the duty rate is higher...
That's where it compounds. Alcohol duties hit 30% in some countries. On $1 million shipment of spirits, you're looking at $300,000 in deferred duties. Even at today's interest rates, the carrying cost of that cash is real money. The bonded storage fees start to look cheap by comparison.
Here's a concrete example that makes this visceral. A spirits importer I read about brings in single malt Scotch whiskey. A container holds roughly 1,000 cases. At a landed cost of maybe $40 per bottle wholesale, you're looking at around $500,000 in product value per container. Federal excise tax plus customs duty on distilled spirits can run north of $20 per proof gallon. On that single container, the duty bill is well into six figures. If the importer is holding that whiskey for 6 months while it awaits distribution to different states, bonded storage means that six-figure sum stays in their operating account earning interest or funding other purchases. The storage facility charges them maybe a few $1,000s a month. It's not even close.
The warehouse isn't just storage. It's a cash flow tool disguised as a building. And I want to connect this to something you said earlier about the bond itself. The surety bond that makes all this possible. What does that actually cost the warehouse operator?
Typically, a fraction of the bond amount. If customs requires a bond covering $100,000 in potential duties, the operator might pay the surety company an annual premium of 1-3% of that, so $1,000 to $3,000 a year. It's relatively cheap because the surety has done its underwriting and determined the operator is low risk. And the operator passes that cost through to their customers as part of the storage fee. So the whole system runs on fairly thin margins at the infrastructure level, but enables enormous cash flow savings at the importer level.
It gets better, because you're not limited to just leaving the goods untouched. CBP allows what they call manipulation. Repackaging, relabeling, quality inspection, even light assembly. All inside bonded storage, all without triggering duty liability.
I thought the whole point was that goods are in suspended animation.
That's the misconception. You can take components from multiple countries, assemble them into a finished kit inside bonded storage, and the duties are still deferred until the completed kit enters the domestic market, or never paid at all if you re-export.
The bonded warehouse is also a factory, a tax-free factory.
A light one, but yes. The best example I've seen is the medical device kitting operation at UPS Worldport in Louisville. Components arrive from different countries, sterile packaging from one place, instruments from another, instructions from a third. Inside the bonded facility, workers assemble them into surgical kits. Those kits ship to hospitals worldwide, and if they're going to, say, a hospital in Brazil, they never pay you. They were never legally in the country.
That's an elegant supply chain hack. It's just a convenient assembly room with favorable customs law. But I have to ask, how far does light assembly go before customs says, no, that's manufacturing, and different rules apply?
There's a line, and it's not always perfectly clear. CBP generally allows operations that don't fundamentally change the character of the goods. Repackaging, sorting, testing, cleaning, labeling. Those are clearly allowed. Assembling components into a kit where each component retains its identity is generally allowed. But if you're taking raw materials and transforming them into something new, chemical processing, smelting, substantial manufacturing, that typically requires a different bonded warehouse class or a foreign trade zone designation. The surgical kit example works because the scalpel is still a scalpel. The drape is still a drape. They're just being combined into a single SKU.
This is where the re-export loophole becomes the whole business model for some hubs. Singapore's Changi Airport handled 1.97 million tons of air cargo last year. A huge portion of that never clears Singapore customs. It arrives from China, gets repackaged with manuals in Thai or Vietnamese or Bahasa, and ships out to Southeast Asian markets, all inside bonded transshipment facilities.
Singapore's bonded warehouses are essentially a duty-free editing suite for global supply chains. Goods enter, get reconfigured for different markets, leave. The country provides the secure space and the legal framework, and the value add happens in the gaps. Singapore is selling infrastructure and legal clarity, and in exchange, it captures the economic activity of the repackaging work itself. The jobs, the logistics services, the facility fees.
The physical form follows the function. These aren't 100,000 square foot warehouses. They're flexible bonded zones with workstations, labeling equipment, quality control stations. The warehouse is a workshop with a customs bond attached. You might have a row of tables where workers are unboxing Chinese electronics, inserting Thai language manuals, and resealing the boxes for shipment to Bangkok. The whole operation might occupy the footprint of a medium-sized restaurant.
Which brings us back to Daniel's original question about physical form. The answer turns out to be, bonded storage takes whatever shape the supply chain needs it to take. Giant portside facility for slow-moving bulk goods. Airport cage for time-sensitive electronics. Workbench in Louisville for surgical kits. Repackaging line in Singapore for regional customization. Same legal status, completely different physical realities.
If you're actually running the supply chain, three things should change how you think about this. First, run the duty deferral math before you default to clearing customs immediately. On a $1 million shipment at 5% duty, you're floating $50,000 interest-free for as long as the goods sit in bonded storage. For high-duty goods like distilled spirits at $13.50 per proof gallon, the savings can cover the storage fees entirely and then some. If your supply chain has long lead times or you're holding inventory strategically, bonded storage isn't a cost center. It's a cash flow tool.
The second thing is, don't automatically lease space at the nearest portside facility. If you're moving pharmaceuticals or electronics where every day of delay erodes margin, the airport bonded cage, even that 200 square foot walk-in closet at JFK, may cost more per square foot, but clear faster and sit closer to air freight. Match the physical scale to the velocity of your supply chain, not to the default option. The per square foot cost is the wrong metric if the goods are only in the space for 18 hours.
Third insight, and this one's less obvious. Bonded storage is a negotiation lever with your customs broker. Many brokers bundle bonded warehousing into their service package. But if you're paying for Class 11 public space and only using a fraction of it, or if your goods could sit in a Class 12 private facility you control directly, unbundling might save real money. Compare the duty deferral value against the broker's storage fees line by line. The CBP classification isn't just bureaucratic taxonomy, it determines who can access the space and on what terms.
I want to pause on that broker point because it's one of those things where the incentives can get misaligned. The broker makes money on the bundled service. They have no particular incentive to tell you that you could save money by unbundling. So the supply chain manager, who understands the classification system, has an edge. They can look at the invoice and say, wait, why am I paying for Class 11 public space when my goods never commingle with anyone else's inventory, and I could operate a Class 12 private space for less?
Class 12 gives you something else, control. In a Class 11 public facility, you're sharing space with other importers. Their compliance problems can become your problem. If CBP audits the facility because someone else is cutting corners, your goods get caught up in the inspection. In a Class 12 private facility, you control the environment, the access, the procedures. The bond is yours alone.
Looking forward, the physical form keeps shrinking as e-commerce customs rules evolve. Section 321 de minimis and its equivalents. The logical endpoint is bonded micro-fulfillment. Not a warehouse near the port, not even a cage at the airport, but bonded lockers at the edge of the last mile. Goods sit in a secure cabinet in an urban center, duties unpaid until the moment of final delivery. The warehouse becomes a locker. The locker becomes a line item on a digital manifest.
That's the open question we're sitting with. Those 2,900 plus CBP authorized facilities, that's just one country's count. Globally, bonded warehouses number in the tens of thousands. And we're entering a period where trade fragmentation is accelerating. Tariffs, sanctions, regionalization. The more borders harden, the more valuable these legal limbo zones become.
Neutral ground in a trade war. Goods parked in a bonded facility aren't committed to any market yet. If tariffs spike tomorrow, you re-export to a different buyer. The warehouse becomes a strategic waiting room. It's a real option embedded in physical space. You're paying storage fees not just for space, but for the right to decide later which market to enter.
Which means the physical form is going to keep collapsing inward. We've traced it from warehouses to rooms to cages to lockers. The next step is digital bonds that track goods in transit, where the customs guarantee attaches to the shipment itself, not to a fixed location. The legal concept outlasts the physical building.
The bond becomes the container. The warehouse was always just the box it came in.
Next time you see a cargo plane land, think about everything sitting inside that aircraft that's in the country but not in the country. And the invisible infrastructure, the bonds, the cages, the lockers, the surety agreements, that makes that possible. It's one of those systems that's everywhere and invisible until you look for it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Suriname's colonial postal service recorded a carrier who, rather than delivering letters along his assigned route, buried them in marked locations and charged recipients a retrieval fee, effectively inventing the world's first geocached postal sabotage.
A retrieval fee? So he created a treasure hunt and charged people to participate in it. That's not a postal service, that's an escape room with mail.
Man really looked at the postal system and said, I can make this worse and charge for it. And the recipients paid it. That's the part that gets me. They actually paid the fee.
I mean, what was the alternative? The letters were already in the ground. At that point, you're negotiating with a man who has buried your correspondence. He's got leverage.
It's honestly a pretty good metaphor for bonded warehousing. Your goods are in a hole someone else dug, and you're paying for the privilege of getting them out.
Not entirely wrong. This has been my weird prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's ever looked at a warehouse and wondered what legal fiction was happening inside it. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. For Herman Poppleberry, I'm Korn. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.